and start with your name and your brief description, please.
Yeah, sure. Okay. Well, my name is Pastor Warren Arthur Morgan, commonly known to the Italian as Red Morgan. I joined the Winnipeg Grenadiers in 1938 as a bandman and stayed with them up until 1946. I was born and raised in St. James, and I took my education at Linwood School and Assiniboine School. Military experience that I had before the war were no courses, but we did recruit training and as such in grade square work. I went to Jamaica with the battalion as a bandsman, but while we were in Jamaica, we did other training besides, the same as an infantryman gets, like weapons and drills and booby traps and mines and so on and so forth. In fact, I think the bandsmen, who had more time than the other soldiers, who did a lot of guard duty, were better trained because they had more time for training. I stayed in Jamaica with the battalion for about 18 months, and then we were posted back to Canada. We stayed in Canada for about a month and a half, and then we were posted to Hong Kong. It was kind of a mixed up, I presume, or a hurried transfer of units to go to Hong Kong, because nobody seemed to know what they were doing, and everybody was just sort of shoved on a train and shoved on a boat. And you're lucky if you got fed, and if you didn't get fed, well, too bad, you had to wait till the next meal. In Vancouver, we had a problem with the troops. Some of them didn't want to stay on the boat because of the cramped quarters and the poor treatment they'd received. We had breakfast about 6 o'clock that morning on the train, and it was after 6 o'clock at night, and we hadn't had anything to eat all that day, but we'd been cooped up aboard a troop ship in the harbor. Consequently, the results of this, the results of the ruckus or confrontation, whatever you want to call it, with the authorities, caused the boat to sail a day too soon, and we weren't fully loaded. So consequently, when we got to Hong Kong, we didn't have all the supplies we were supposed to have. Anyhow, it took us 3 weeks to get to Hong Kong and aboard the boat. We did some very quick, fast training, such as supposedly assault landings, and we took a mortar, 2-inch mortar training, and the rifle training, and they gave us a few lectures on how to behave when we landed ashore with the Chinese, and so on and so forth. But all in all, the trip over was not too eventful. We were very cramped, though, and I know one thing, that we had mutton 3 times a day. Mutton for breakfast, mutton for dinner, and mutton for supper. And if you're hungry and had managed to get something to eat at night, you still got mutton. Well, we landed in Hong Kong, and we got off the boat and paraded to Shamshapo Barracks. And when we got into Shamshapo Barracks, they allotted us our quarters, and the band was quartered in a separate old married quarter building, which later became our prison camp and our hospital when we were prisoners of war. While we were in Hong Kong, we were taken on a trip across to the island of Hong Kong from Kowloon, and shown where our positions would be in the event of warfare. And I was with D Company, as you were. I was with Headquarters Company, and we were allotted the Wanchai Gap area and down around the reservoir. What the heck's the name of the dark thing? Aberdeen Reservoir, in that area anyhow. That was our area for Headquarters Company. We went back to the Kowloon side, and we're just more or less getting settled into our quarters and the routine of garrison life when war was declared. The next day, same day war was declared, we were moved out across to our positions on Hong Kong side. Being in headquarters company, we were in the middle, and consequently we didn't see too much action. Only on the last 3 days, A Company and B Company and D Company were the companies that had most of the action, but we saw action for only the last 3 days. Towards the end, when we surrendered, nobody knew whether we were going to surrender or what had gone on, and it was just sort of a terrible mix-up. But we all seemed to congregate at Wan Chai Gap, and there we were told that we had surrendered, and that was on Christmas Day. I wasn't wounded, although quite a few of my friends were. I was fortunate, I guess. We were taken back from the island of Hong Kong over to our own old army barracks, Sham Shui Po, and there we were interned as prisoners of war. And I think at that time the Japanese gave the impression that they didn't know what to do with us. They had they weren't quite prepared to take prisoners, and they really didn't know what to do with us. So consequently, we were pretty well left on our own for the first 3 weeks. And the only food that we had was the food that we had in our knapsacks. And if we didn't have any, those that didn't have food in their knapsacks, well, they just went without, or the rest of us shared it. So consequently, that 3 weeks, when we were first prisoners, resulted in many of the men becoming very sick, and they lost a tremendous amount of weight, and I don't think they ever really fully recovered after that. Well, about after 3 weeks, they started to give us a bowl of rice a day, and we had a bowl of rice and whatever other greens, or sometimes they'd give us fish or something that we could scrounge, beg, or borrow, we ate. Along about that time, the men started getting dysentery and diphtheria. And we only had four doctors, but we only had two medical orderlies with us. So Colonel Crawford asked for volunteers to work in the hospital because they had about 200 patients and really nobody looked after them. So I volunteered and went to work in the hospital, along with, I think Johnny Maston was another one, with the Grenadiers, and there was a chap by the name of Pat Poirier, who was with the Royal Rifles of Canada, and I think Mel McKnight and Elmer McKnight of the Grenadiers. Those are the ones of us that volunteered to go and work in the hospital. We didn't have any hospital training, but we certainly learned in a hurry, because actually we didn't have much medical equipment. I often tell the story about the doctor coming around, especially Dr. Reed. He used to come around all the time, and the men all liked him, and he seemed to work well with the men. But he would come around, and he'd say, Frank, you better give so-and-so an enema. And then he'd say, and also, so-and-so needs throat irrigation, and so on. And I used to say to the men, okay, and we'd use the same irrigation can for the enema and throat, so it didn't really matter. All we did was wash it off and use it, because we only had one. We made medical equipment like bedpans out of old soy buckets and tin cans or anything we could get our hands on. We didn't have too many blankets. We had no medical equipment. We had no medicine. In fact, we didn't have anything. And I remember the saddest part of it all was that many of the men just give up and die. They just quit. And I don't know, I was always one that would never refuse a challenge, and we didn't have anybody there to prepare the men for burial, so they said, well, good old Frank, you'll do it, and I did it. But I suppose it worked all right. I guess I never had any complaints anyhow. After we stayed in Hong Kong for about a year, they came around and divided us up into groups and said, you, you're going, you. Next day we got on a boat and we ended up in Japan. We didn't even know we were going there, but that's where we ended up. We ended up just outside of Tokyo, between Tokyo and Yokohama, in a camp called 3D. And there were about 500 of us. We worked in a shipyard, and we stayed there for about till 1944. One of the things about our move to Japan was that we got a little better food for the first year, because Japan was winning the war and they had all kinds of food and everything, and they gave us not too bad treatment there. But then when the squeeze started to come on about 1943, then they started to squeeze the prisoners of war, and we got practically nothing, maybe a bowl and a half of rice a day and soup sometimes, and sometimes a piece of fish. Very seldom ever saw meat. We used to get shark fins, and we had that. And that's about what we had. We were fortunate, though, in that we worked outside the camp in the shipyard, and we were able to trade stuff with the civilians who used to give us rice balls and the odd bit of meat and stuff. Red Cross parcels, we only got, as far as I can remember, we only ever got two. And what we did with the Red Cross parcels, most of us, was we saved everything that was in it except the coffee. We drank that. The rest we traded for rice and soap and things with the Japanese people, especially the chocolate bars.
What do you think of the Japanese guards while you were in
the prison? Well, Japanese guards were the same as any other guard. The ones that we had, some were good and some were bad. And most of them weren't very good. That's difficult to give a definite opinion on a guard. It's the same as we are. One man is a humanitarian and the next one's a pig. So how do you decide? Some were good, some were bad. And you got to know who the good ones were and who the bad ones were. And when the half-decent ones were around, well, you could get away with things. But when the others weren't, well, you just didn't do it. I had two or three experiences while I was in the camp. I used to... The Japanese had their own guard set up, and they had their own medical treatment room for their own troops and so on in the headquarters building. Well, they had sulfadiazine in there, and they had thiamine, and they had a few tablets and pills around that would come in handy for our people. And I know I used to like to get in there as often as I could, because then I'd steal the stuff and we'd use it for our own people. I got caught two or three times like everybody else, I guess, but it didn't matter. We did this. I worked pretty closely with Dr. Reed all during our sojourn in Japan as the medical orderly for the camp, and we used to buy, actually. The men got paid, by the way. Yeah, this was a farce. We used to get paid 10 cents a day for working in the shipyard, but they would pay us quite religiously every 2 weeks. But it wouldn't do us any good because we couldn't spend the money. So what we used to do is pool the money, and Dr. Reed, through our interpreter at the camp where we were, he wasn't too bad. A lot of times we were able to buy... vitamin B1 in 1 milligram vials, and we maybe buy 1,000 of them for, I don't know what we paid for them, and then Dr. Reed would bring them in and he'd say, okay, Frank, this is what we're going to give this number of men, and he'd pick out the groups that a man that needed it worse than anybody else, and we used to line them up and give them inoculations. We used the same needle and the same syringe, and I used to sharpen the needle and give 25 injections, and then sharpen the needle again and give another 25, and so on and so forth. But
this was for beriberi, was it, or disease?
Yeah, for beriberi mostly. A lot of the chaps, well, probably everybody had beriberi. Everybody had dysentery, although some were cured, but they never were really cured. It always was there, and their stools were loose, and they were always in a weakened condition. It didn't take long for disease to, you know, didn't take long for them to get run down, and everybody had worms. Most of them had worms. 90% of them, I guess, had worms, which took a lot of their goodness out of the food that they did get when they ate it. They suffered probably from scurvy too, I guess. I don't know. The biggest thing was vitamin deficiency, though, because we just ate rice. That's all. And you get a half a bowl of rice at in the morning and a half a bowl at night, and that's about all. And some, we used to call it marigold soup. Soup made of marigolds, I guess. I don't know, or daikons. But you know, all in all, it wasn't a very good experience, although you tend to remember the funny things that happened rather than the bad things, you know.
Can you remember any of these things that you felt were funny at the time?
Oh, yeah, I suppose. I could just have to think for a minute. But, oh, yeah, one of the things that used to strike me as funny was this pay parade bit. I used to think this was real, real funny, because they pay us every 2 weeks regular, and nobody can spend the money. Then when Christmas come, oh, everybody's going to have a big Christmas party, and they'd let you decorate everything up all over the place, and Christmas Day, everybody'd be happy, but they wouldn't give you anything to eat. But anyhow, yeah, you had to be happy on Christmas Day. Or on their holidays, you had to be happy that day. It didn't matter whether you were fit or not. These were the strange and funny things that I used to, I don't know, stupid things, I call them, I guess.
Couldn't you use this money when there was no canteen where you could purchase things or trade it with the people?
No, nothing. Well, we didn't have anything. Yeah, the people didn't want money either. They had all kinds of money. What they wanted was soap, and what they wanted was chocolate bars and stuff like this. They wanted the niceties. Like, they didn't have them any more than we did. But we worked. The men worked in the shipyard most of the time. In fact, but towards the end of, well, before they bombed us out there in 1943, early 44, just before they bombed us out, it was the prisoners of war that were running the more or less running the shipyard, because there wasn't anybody else left except prisoners of war and men. I will say that in Hong Kong, we lost an awful lot of prisoners of war who died from starvation and died from dysentery and died from diphtheria. But when we were in Japan, in the camp that I was in, our losses were cut down by about half. I think, as I say, first of all, we got fed pretty good the first year we were there. And I think towards the end, they were, unless they were really, really sick and got jaundice or something like that, which, as far as we were concerned, a lot of things were hopeless. We couldn't treat them. They usually died. There wasn't anything we could do about it. The other part of it was too, when they got beriberi, they had this, as the Dr. Reed used to say, they call a boot heart. The muscle lets go in the heart, and it makes the heart shaped like a boot, you know. And many of them that got this, they died. They called it malnutrition, but it was probably just the fact that it was either heart failure or they just give up. I know I remember one incident very plainly. I suppose I'll never forget it. He was my best friend, too. In fact, he was the best man at our wedding. Jimmy Forbes was his name. We were always pretty close, and, you know, I used to talk to him and one thing and another, and he came in one day into the hospital, and he said, "Frank, I'm tired." And I said, "Well, what's the matter, Jim?" And he said, "Oh, I just think I'll give up." I said, "No, don't you dare give up." And, you know, he did. He gave up. Next day he died. Just like that. Well, a lot of prisoners did that. Many of them gave up. They just quit, you know. That's all there was to it.
Was diphtheria, was that a fairly fast killer, or was that...
Yeah, their throats used to fill up. You know, and it wasn't only that, the diphtheria, it was that they had a combination of three. They'd have diphtheria, beriberi, and diarrhea. And not diarrhea, dysentery, actually. And they'd have bacillary dysentery or amoebic dysentery. And bacillary dysentery is a type of dysentery that your frequent stools, you could go to the bathroom 100 times in a period of 9 hours. And you don't pass anything except the fluid out of your body and the mucus, that's all. And so the man consequently became terribly dehydrated. And you could see a man literally just waste away in a day and a half. Without, you know, I don't know all the medical terms, although I was involved with all of it, I know a few of the things about it. The sad part was that they didn't... You can't blame the Japanese in a lot of ways for a lot of things that happened, because the Japanese didn't know any better themselves. Their treatment for sickness was what we used to call moxibustion. In the fact, if you had a sore hand, then they'd put this little punka thing on your elbow and burn it on your elbow so your elbow got sore and take the pain away from your hand. Now, this is they still do it in Japan today, but that's how cruel or how crude their medical knowledge was at that time.
So they were quite ignorant then. Most medical.
Well, it seemed the people that we associated with didn't have a clue.
There were no Japanese doctors or anything?
Yeah, we used to have one come in all the time, and his favorite saying was, no pain, no gain. Well, that's the same theory of gain of, you know, burning one place and to take the pain away from the other.
Did any of the guards ever contract these diseases, or is it...
Oh, sure. Guards had dysentery. They didn't have diphtheria, though. I often wondered where diphtheria came from, how we got it, because most of our people were inoculated with it. You know, from the time we were children, we were all inoculated for diphtheria or vaccinated. But it's just one of those things that happened, and once it did come, it really spread. At one time in the hospital there, we had nearly 400 patients. And I will say that all 400 had diphtheria. But it's strange. Dr. Reed at the time said that the medical book says that those people who are not inoculated against diphtheria, out of 100, 32 will die. The rest will recover. And that's exactly what happened.
Was there a serum available that would cure diphtheria?
There could have been serum available, but the Japanese wouldn't give it to us.
This would cure diphtheria once the men had it, would it?
Oh, yeah, once they got inoculated, yeah, sure, it would cure. It would help them, you know.
But two-thirds recovered once they had it just by themselves, didn't they?
Oh, yeah, two-thirds recovered by themselves. The point was, Hong Kong, were we in Hong Kong and those poor unfortunate people that stayed there, that was about the worst place you could have been as a prisoner.
This was North Point camp.
Yeah, right. Well, North Point was one of them and Sham Shui Po was the other. Mm-hmm. Because it was, I don't know, we had, I don't remember their names, but we had an interpreter there. He was an American. Or no, he wasn't. He was a Canadian. He'd been born in Japan, raised in Canada, went back to Japan. And he was a holy terror. He was the interpreter. And I think many times that he was the one that caused all the fuss and all the bad feeling and all the bad treatment that we got. I'm sure that he was the one that did it. Because I feel sure that he... although we would say something, when he translated it into Japanese, he'd turn it around. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it actually, later on, he wouldn't have been able to do that because most of us got so that we could understand quite a bit of Japanese. So that, you know, in fact, I think the large majority of us, when we came home, We all spoke Japanese more than we did English. Sort of bit.
Did you ever find out what happened to this interpreter?
Oh, yeah, I think they got 20 years in jail out of that, or they hung him, I don't know. Two or three they tried for war crimes trials, I guess. I didn't go back. A couple of lads went back as witnesses. But, well, then, anyhow, after we worked at, in 3D camp for till 1944, I guess, one day, I think it was in April. I may be wrong, but it's in that area, in the spring, anyhow. We had been bombed before by American planes, but not too many. But then all of a sudden, this day, they started about 5 o'clock at night, and they didn't quit till about 6 o'clock the next morning, and the sky was just black with them. And it was a Tokyo fire raid, and they just burnt the area completely flat. And the day before, you couldn't see anywhere. And the next day, you could see probably 20 miles in every direction, and all it was just smokestacks standing or the odd cement building, but the rest was absolutely burnt flat. We were fortunate in the fact that our camp, we got hit a couple of times, but we were able to put the fire bombs out and control it. And also we were fortunate because our camp bordered a canal. There was a canal on one side of us, a road on the other side of us, and a large field on the other side, so that although the fire was all around us, it didn't jump and come to where we were. We were sort of very fortunate, I often thought. Well, then after the fire raid and that large bombing raid, we stayed there for 2 days, and then they marched us out and put us on a train, and we went up north to a place called Onahama. It was a coal mine, and they moved us up into a coal mine. They, and that was the time that I'd been a medical orderly all along and been in camp most of the time, although I'd been to the shipyard quite often, and you know, but that when we got up to Onahama, some of the other men were not too good a shape, and especially to go down a coal mine, so Dr. Reed asked me if I would switch with some of the weaker ones and let one of the weaker ones take my place, and would I go and take his place in the mine? And I said yes, and I did that. So I worked in the mine for the last part of the war. And the funny thing about that was, and the strange thing about working in the mine, it wasn't too bad. We had some bad guards there too, but it wasn't too bad. And the strangest thing was that once again, in their quirks and their mind, I don't know why they did it, they would, every 2 weeks or 3 weeks, they'd have a Yasume day or half a Yasume day, and all the prisoners would line up in the parade square, and they, I don't know how they picked people, but they'd call out your name, and you'd go up there, and they'd give you 2 bowls of rice and maybe 10 cigarettes, Japanese cigarettes, and tell you that you're one of the good workers and you're a good worker in the mine and so on and so forth, and then they give you a pair of Japanese socks or something, and I don't know why they ever did this, but this is what they used to do when actually we could have done with food for everybody, but they did these strange things. I don't know why, probably thinking they're going to build our morale, I don't know.
This was a coal mine you were working
in? Yeah, worked in a coal mine. We had to make so many carloads of coal a day, which we never did. We're supposed to make 8, but we never did. We never made. I think it was the biggest day we ever worked down there. We made 4.
Can you describe the working conditions in the mine? Were they bad?
Well, they were. Actually, I'd never been down a mine before. It was quite an experience. But the Japanese, once again, to our ways, they do things backwards. You went down into the mine in the foul air shaft, and if you've ever been in a foul air shaft in a mine, it really stinks something terrible. And the fresh air shaft, they hauled the coal up it instead of the other way around. But down the mine wasn't very good. We worked in water about 10, 12 inches deep. Used to wear just a little G-string and a pair of running shoes or sneakers. It was really hot down there. There wasn't too much. There was air, but not that much air. And then we worked on the coal face. And of course, coal's hot anyhow. And the temperature down there would probably be 120 degrees, 125 degrees. in the mine, and their air system wasn't too good. And then I was fortunate, I got switched to the rock face. They were cutting some tunnels in on rock. And I worked in the rock face in the tunnel, and it wasn't too bad there because there was no coal, it was just rock. And there wasn't that great heat from the rock as there is from the coal. But still, you know, it was a lot of water. We didn't have any Kievans when we were there. We had just a small one, but it wasn't anything to sort of speak of. And then that's where we found out the war was over. In fact, we were down the mine on our shift. We used to work shift work there, 3 shifts a day, or in a 24-hour period. You worked either mornings, evenings, or nights, and it was 3 shifts. But I was on the night shift, I guess. Yeah. And we're having a rest period. And I don't know how it happened, but I think one of the Japanese guards said to us that the war was over. I guess he said the war was over, that Tojo had made a speech, and the war was over. So we sort of cleaned up the mine, and then we came up, and then we knew, because we came up before our ship was over. Our ship was over, and we knew right away then that something was up. Well, when we got to the top of the mine, our boys were all there, and they said the war's over, and so on and so forth.
Did you have any idea before this that the war might be coming close to an end? Or?
No, we didn't, but we did know. We knew that things were getting pretty grim for the Japanese people, because our mine was up in the mountain, you see, and we used to stand on the side of the road or in the camp, and we could see our own battleships and wagons out to sea lobbing shells in the town below us. And they were just standing off there hammering away, and there wasn't a soul touching them. You know, so it was, we kind of figured that things were going bad, but we didn't think the war was over, to tell you the truth, until they told us. And then, how I got from the camp, once again being medical, after I came up with the mine, old Doc Reed came over and he said to me, "Well, Frank, I want you to come back and work with us in the hospital, and because we need you." So I started working in the hospital again. Then about a day later, American aircraft flew over and dropped some leaflets, and they said that they would, if we marked an area in the camp, that they would come back and drop some food supplies. Well, we marked an area in the camp, and they came back and dropped some food supplies. And the funny thing about that was, what I remember was the fact that the first thing they dropped was a big 45-gallon drum of peaches. And they had on these big cargo chutes on them, and the chute broke and the peaches came down, hit the railroad track, and they just splattered all over. And here, we hadn't seen peaches for 4 years, and everybody was into the peaches. It didn't matter a day. Stuff was falling all around, all over the place. And so what we did was we gathered it all up and piled it in a big pile in the middle of the yard and said to everybody, "Okay, if you want something, go to help yourself." Sort of it.
Did this make any of the men sick once they started eating all this food?
Oh, sure. A lot of them got sick. Everybody got sick. We weren't really worried about getting sick. I guess we were too hungry. Anyhow, how I got out of there, I came out of there sooner than the rest of the gang, because we had 6 men in the hospital that were really sick. And Dr. Reed said that if they didn't get treatment right away, they would die. And then now that the war was over, he couldn't see any sense in keeping them there. So what happened was, he said, "We'll take them down to the station, and if there's trains running, and there were, we were lucky, we'll put them on the train, we'll take them into Tokyo, because we know the Americans are in there. And will you come?" And I said, "Sure." So anyhow, what happened was, myself, Doc Reed, and I think Johnny Masson, and I can't remember who else, but there were 4 of us. And we carried these guys about 3 miles down to the train. No, we didn't carry them all. We carried Johnny and I, and carried one, and a couple other fellows carried one, so on. But we carried them down to the train in the town. We put them on the train, and we took them into Tokyo. And when we got into Tokyo, we were expected to meet the Americans, and we met the Australians. They were there. So In actual fact, from there, things were, we went through a sort of a delousing. Well, we got rid of our patients first. We took them to the American Field Hospital, and then from there, there was a hospital ship in the harbor, and they took them into harbor, and I think one of them they operated on right away. He had a tumor in behind his nose. In fact, it was sort of growing out his nose, you know. Anyhow, they operated on him, and he's okay, and the other three or four, yeah, old Soroka, he's in Winnipeg here, he's okay, and I can't remember the other names of the chaps. Well, anyhow, they deloused us in one thing or another, and then once again, the same old army bit, they shoved us aboard a bloody ship, and we stayed in the harbor for about 5 days aboard an American landing craft vehicle called the, what the heck was the name, USS? Ozark or something. And we stayed there. They had the vehicle deck all prepared, and we had beds on there, and we stayed there for 3 or 4 days until we loaded, you know, other people got loaded up. Then after that, after we were aboard the ship, we stayed there for about 4 days, as I say, and then we went to Guam. And when we got to Guam, they took us off the ship and put us in hospital, and we were in the hospital for 3 days in Guam, 3-4 days. They did a complete check of everybody to see whether we were fit to travel, and then we left Guam and we went to Honolulu, and we stayed in Honolulu for 2 days. And then we came into San Francisco, and we went over to a place called McNabb's Island. And once again, true to Canadian standards, everybody else that was prisoners of war had got paid and everything else, and here we were, poor Canadians with no pay, no nothing, and somebody came down from Vancouver, a big shot, and he gave us $20 each. And they finally gave us a uniform. And we stayed there for 3 days, and the $20, you may as well have just give us nothing, actually. Well, then we got on a train, and we went by train from there to Victoria, or Vancouver, and then we went Vancouver across to Victoria, and we stayed at Gordon Head for about, I can't remember, probably a week, I guess. And I think they gave us another $20. And, well, they did a lot of medical tests and one thing and another, and then they said, okay, they shipped us on a train, and we came back to Winnipeg.
How did the Americans treat you on your way from, all the way from Tokyo to
San
Francisco?
They treated us good because they thought we were Americans. So they gave us, oh God, everything. Anything you want, you could have had. Jackets, boots, clothes, everything. When we landed in San Francisco, you'd have thought we were a bunch of Americans because all we had on was American uniforms and American clothes. Well, then we got to San Francisco. We had to shed them because Big Soul gave us some battle dress and a $20 bill, which I thought most of us were sort of disappointed, actually, because we wanted to take some things home, but we didn't.
Once you got home, you didn't get discharged from the army then?
No, when I got home, we got 2 months leave. And I got promoted too, by the way. When I got home, I had been promoted since 1941 and I didn't know. And I was a sergeant when I got home. So, but anyhow, the back pay was a nice part of it. But I'd been a sergeant since 1941, but hadn't known about it. But I did when we got home. When we had about 2 months leave, then Mrs. Morgan and I sat down one day and discussed what we were going to do and what I wanted to do and what would be best for everybody. And I asked her if she would go along with me by staying in the service. And she said, if that's what you want to do, then that's okay with me. So consequently, I transferred to the regular force and stayed in the service. Now, I think the best thing that happened to me was that I only had 2 months leave and then I went right back to work. Mind you, I wasn't in the best of shape, but I went back to work and I stayed working. I think maybe, with the care I got at home and the good meals and everything, and on top of that, and the work and everything, I came out of it relatively in relatively good health after a period of about a year. And I stayed, pretty well up until, 4 years ago, I started having some problems. And, well, I always did have problems, but I never bothered them about them. But I started having sore feet and sore legs and muscles, and I got high blood pressure and one thing and another. So I went sick about 4 years ago, and they sent me to the Pensions Commission. And gosh, next thing I knew, I had a 50% disability pension. But I must say that all in all, with the exception of the odd individual, the Canadian government treated us okay. I find they did to me. You meet the odd individual in an organization which figures that anything he gives you, it belongs to him rather than the government, and it's unfortunate some people meet these type and they can't do anything about it. But I was always fortunate to be able to meet people who were sympathetic and understood. The exception of one individual in Edmonton, but other than that, I got no complaints. I can't complain at all.
So you feel the government's treated you fairly then since 1945?
Oh, certainly I do. My feelings are that you don't get in for nothing. Anything you got to work for it. But if you figure just because, I always felt, if you figure just because you're a prisoner of war and somebody made a mistake sending you there in the first place, that they should, the rest of your life, they're supposed to pay you back, well, that's just nonsense.
What are your feelings toward the Japanese people, Jimmy?
No different than the Arrow War. They did what we did. Well, they had a war to fight. They thought they were right. We had a war to fight. We thought we were right. I often wonder sometimes how we ever won it. Wars are something that never settles anything. It's better to lose a war than to win it, because all the countries that lost the wars are better off than we are.
Mm-hmm. And just as a final question, what are your thoughts about war then? Or did you just sum it up in your last sentence?
Well, war doesn't solve anything. It never will solve anything. A war won't solve anything. If our democracy, and we feel that we live in a democracy, and we feel that, say, for example, communism and democracy won't work, and that communism is bad and democracy is right, if we have to go to war to prove it, I don't think we should. It should be settled at a conference table. Also, I feel that if we do have to go to war, then it should only be two people. And the two people are the two heads of state. That's what they get paid for. Let them shoot it out. And whoever wins, okay, then we abide by the decision. But war doesn't solve anything. It gives you the economy of the country. It gets a great boost because everything is going full tilt and full production for war. But I hope there's never another war. I hope my son doesn't have to go to war. Or I hope nobody else's sons have to go to war, or daughters.